Welcome to episode 47 of the Infectious Historians Podcast. I'm Merle Eisenberg.
And I'm Lee Mordecai.
It's February 4th, and in today's episode, we're going to talk about the history of HIV and AIDS in the 20th and 21st centuries.
This is one of the most significant contemporary diseases when it comes to public health, global health, and reshaping the narratives and ideas people around the world have told and have been telling about disease and medicine.
Our guest today is Richard McKay. Richard is a Wellcome Trust Fellow in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Cambridge. He works on 20th century history of medicine and public health, and his first book came out in 2017, which was entitled Patient Zero and the Making of the AIDS Epidemic with Chicago University Press. He also wrote an article entitled The History of Science and Medicine in the Context of COVID-19 in the journal Centaurus that was one of the first special issues to be published on histories of disease in light of COVID.
Rich has also been involved in public-facing work. He wrote a few such articles that examine the place of the social history of medicine in the public sphere. His work on the idea of patient zero was adapted for theater productions, while his book was made into a documentary film, and Rich served as a historical consultant on the set. His current research project is entitled Before HIV, Homo Sex and Venereal Disease, 1939 till 1984. And this examines the process by which healthcare workers and gay men, among other groups, became increasingly interested in the role played by men who had sex with men in the transmission of sexually transmitted infections. And maybe we should also mention that Rich is also a credentialed and practicing career academic and life coach. So hi, Rich, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be here.
So, Merle, HIV and AIDS are perhaps the most significant disease of the late 20th century and 21st centuries, both in terms of their impact at the time, but also their impact on the way that people think about disease up to the present. And we've touched upon this important moment, so the 1980s and early 1990s, in various episodes in terms of memory and movies, but we've never really discussed in detail the role that AIDS played in this.
Yeah, I think you're right, Lee. That's why I was looking forward to this podcast, since it seemed to me to be one of the key diseases that we hadn't touched upon. And I should say we've known this was a major gap in this podcast, but it's also a time period, the later 20th century, where, and I'll speak for myself, Lee, we're probably the least comfortable in terms of academic research, and also that AIDS itself is such a huge topic and so important, so I didn't even know where to start. But once I came across Rich's work that looks at the impact of AIDS on the way we think about diseases, it seemed like the perfect place to start on the topic. But before we get to the actual discussion, how are things in Jerusalem, Lee? Anything new since we last talked, or really just same old, usual politics and all?
I guess it's more of the same old, same old. We're still on lockdown. The lockdown is supposed to be partially lifted tomorrow. We still don't know because the government, as usual, waits until the very last moment it can to decide. Actually, a week ago, they waited until the last minute, literally the last minute, before they decided to continue the lockdown. So now, tomorrow may be a lockdown and maybe not. Incidentally, it's also my daughter's first birthday tomorrow.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. And that means that we actually don't really know what we're supposed to do. So we invited her grandparents over for this birthday, but maybe there's going to be a lockdown. And if so, we'll have to cancel. That's pretty annoying, I would say. Now, I've also been thinking in this context about COVID and its impact on politics around the world, let's say. And I'm a bit surprised that COVID didn't result in more dramatic political changes. Over 2020, at least, there has been very high mortality, but governments continue to function. We haven't seen any mass demonstrations or mass protests on this specific point. I mean, yes, there have been demonstrations and protests against other points, but not this particular one. And we've seen maybe some instability in Israel, maybe some changes in the United States, but that was much slower than what I would expect if you would have told me that a worldwide pandemic would kill as many people before 2020.
I have to say one other thing that's interesting reflecting on the US perspective on Israel is, as you know, you guys have been held up as this great case study for how well COVID is going. especially obviously in terms of vaccination rates. And so I know listening to you on this podcast, it's pretty interesting, we'll leave it as that, to hear the difference between the discourse that I read really all over the place and what you've told me about. But, you know, I think that's to be expected.
As we've said earlier, there are a lot of interests involved in this discourse, people, institutions, governments who have specific parts they're trying to play or trying to fill. And I guess because this is not a politics podcast, so I guess we can probably leave it at this.
Yeah, I'll just note that both of us, as our key term, used the word interest and interesting, which is perhaps the most oblique word in English academic discourse. And I say this specifically as we have Rich on, who's an English academic in the sense of he works in England. And that has a very particular connotation in England versus the United States versus Germany. And this was actually one thing that I had to learn, was the different ways in which that term is used in different academic settings. But that's for another discussion, perhaps.
But how are things in Annapolis?
Yeah, so on a local note, you know, personal note, I guess, I mentioned the snow that was happening in the last episode, which was a lot of fun. The kids went outside and played in it. But it also meant that on Monday and Tuesday, because we're in Annapolis, Maryland, we had snow days. Not a lot of snow, right? 4 or 5 inches maybe. But that basically shut down the whole city because there's no snow plows and no real salt put on the roads. So the kids were home for 5 days straight, and that was less than fun. What actually kind of made me think in retrospect was, and I guess I would have to go back and listen to old episodes of our podcast, Lee, I don't know how I survived the first 6 months with no childcare. I mean, I think in retrospect, it's probably like the first 3 months your daughter was alive, which is that you just black it out. And so you don't remember how terrible it is. That's about all.
Yeah.
But it's also a different reality, I think, in a sense. And I'll just leave it at this, which is, I think in the first 3 months, first 6 months, when it came to everyone working and employers, many more people were willing to cut you slack, right? So everyone had their kid Zoom bombing. Everyone had their kid, you know, doing stuff in their presentations. Everyone was working weird hours and it was kind of okay. But I think as of this fall, and certainly by now, it's kind of expected that you're supposed to, quote unquote, be doing normal stuff again and be on a normal time zone, which is obviously not even remotely possible. But it's kind of an interesting mix, which is we're getting to a schedule in which everything we do is very normal, quote unquote, in a COVID context, but none of this is obviously the same.
So what you're saying, Merle, is that this is the new norm.
Yeah, to use a very overused phrase, but it's just something I personally realized, I think, when my kids were home.
I guess I'll just say interesting.
So, so where are you, Rich, and how are things there?
So I'm in London, where I live with my husband and two dogs. And we have been under, the city of London's been under fairly tight restrictions since before Christmas. And the UK or England, because health is devolved and there's separate decision making in the different countries. But England has been under a national lockdown since early January, which compared to other countries' versions of lockdown feels lighter. People still leave their houses. Traffic is a lot lighter on the streets. There is less congregating. But compared to the first lockdown that happened in March of 2020, there is more restaurant activity, etc. I'd say there's a mixed mood. There's real optimism about the, I'd say, single encouraging aspect of the UK's response, which has been a steady vaccination program, albeit there are concerns about the spacing of the doses. On the flip side, we recently passed a terrible marker of 112,000 deaths. That's with COVID-19 listed on the death certificate. And most of those, about 85%, are in England. And that puts us, in terms of total deaths, in the top five countries worldwide, of large countries anyway. And relative to its population size, that put the UK in the unfortunate kind of world-leading position, certainly for a large country, even worse per millions of population than the United States. There's concern that different variants of the virus are at risk of spreading. So there are parts of London, different postcodes, which are under even greater lockdowns with recommendations that people don't even leave their house. And it seems that the concern around the increasing case levels, which at the beginning of January there were calls saying that if the direction didn't change, that the NHS, the National Health Service, was at the risk of having to ration care within a few weeks' time. Those seem to have subsided slightly, and as the numbers seem to be coming down, but they're still very high, and there's more people in hospital now than there were in the first wave in the spring. And then lastly, it's been in the news recently that kind of calls for a national celebration of a recently deceased British Army officer, Captain Sir Tom Moore, who set out to raise £1,000 for the NHS by walking 100 lengths of his garden in the lead up to his 100th birthday, ended up inspiring so many people to do so that in total they raised over £32 million. And sadly, he just died of COVID-19. And I'm aware of very complicated feelings around the clapping that has been suggested and withheld, probably where you are as well, in different places. People are clapping for carers, clapping for the NHS, clapping for hospital workers. And so there was a clap for Tom Moore. The criticism is that the fact that he was having to raise money for the NHS, which was suffering from underfunding from the government, and that the public health services of this country have been sustained funding cuts over a decade, and the way that health workers are having to work without access to the protective equipment that they might need or do need to prevent them from being at much higher risk of infection and dying. There's a sense that, to Lee's point of the no political uprisings, it feels as if the clapping is a way of alleviating and perhaps covering up some of the feelings of protest, etc. And one last point I thought I should say would be that I thought you guys would be particularly interested in a news report saying that the UK's health secretary had his view on securing vaccines for the UK partly influenced by the film Contagion. The need to quickly order and secure orders of the vaccine as early as possible to avoid a global rush. And so it seems like a fitting reminder that all of us, whether politicians or scientists or historians, exist within and consume popular culture.
So I have to ask in this context, do both of you feel that there is a rush to acquire vaccines, which would be equivalent to the rush to acquire masks at the beginning, like about a year ago? Because in my impression, there was a rush to get masks. So different countries tried to get as many masks as possible early on. But now with the vaccines, I think more countries are maybe a bit more concerned or kind of waiting to see how other countries are doing before committing or overcommitting to that.
I would say that my observation is that there is a very strong push to acquire doses for different countries, for their citizens. And I know that there was some consternation back in Canada for the disruption in production of vaccines that caused delays in plans to roll out vaccinations. And so that would be my observation.
I would just say, to build on Rich's point about popular culture influencing how people think, the vaccines as the way out of this have been essentially touted, at least in a US media context, from the beginning practically, right? So from March and April, everyone was basically saying, this will only get better when we get vaccinated. And so that's been the strong narrative throughout this process, over and beyond anything that people are doing themselves, whether it means masking, social distancing, et cetera, et cetera. And so in that sense, that's been the narrative the whole time, right? That we have this view, we as great 21st century people can come up with these vaccines extremely quickly, roll them out extremely quickly, and then we'll all be better again. So that's maybe a good segue then into the deeper discussion on HIV and AIDS. So maybe you can just tell us very briefly, as the running joke I think now in this podcast is, what is HIV and AIDS? And then we'll get into some of the history of it.
Sure. So HIV, or the human immunodeficiency virus, is a viral infection, or more specifically, a retroviral infection, which attacks the body's T cells, which are crucial actors in the body's immune system to help control disease. After someone is infected, after an initial burst of viral activity, the body is able to mount an immune response that helps to keep the infection in check for a long time. But gradually, the T cells become depleted, a process that can take a number of years. And so over that time, gradually, the person will show signs of gradually advancing HIV disease as their immune system shuts down, with the end stage of the onset of AIDS, which is the umbrella description, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, that marks the arrival of an opportunistic infection, a characteristic infection that is indicative that HIV has so depleted the body's immune system. And that could be something like pneumonia, Kaposi sarcoma, skin cancer, cytomegalovirus, cervical cancer, toxoplasmosis. So these are called opportunistic infections because the body might normally be able to fight off these infections, but because of the damaged immune system is not able to do so. And so HIV plus one of these opportunistic infections is what results in AIDS. And we can talk a little bit later about the kind of relative survival rates, but there are some people whose bodies are able to control HIV infection. So they're called long-term non-progressors. They don't progress to end-stage AIDS, but in the absence of treatment, and fortunately there is effective antiretroviral therapy that prevents people from moving along that trajectory. But in the absence of treatment, HIV is over 90% fatal. One thing I might add, it's a really slow disease. And this is really striking in comparison to coronavirus, where we know about the average incubation period kind of ranging from, you know, as short as a couple days, averaging around 5 days and stretching to as many as 14 days. By comparison, HIV is known as a type of virus called a lentivirus, which means slow moving virus. And so somebody could not display symptoms for a number of years before then displaying outward signs of their immune disorder.
Now, when are people infectious? Would asymptomatic individuals be infectious even though they're not displaying any symptoms?
Yes. So there is a period shortly after initial infection when the body has not yet managed to produce an immune response where the virus goes into massive levels of production. So when somebody is newly infected, like within the first few days of being infected, they're much more able to transmit it through their bodily fluids. There's much higher concentrations of the virus. And the concentrations of virus in their bodily fluids will decrease, but they will remain infectious after that. The really good news, and this is kind of a development, people have been more aware of this over the last few years, is that when people are HIV positive and go on to antiretroviral therapy, it reduces the levels of HIV circulating in their systems to almost negligible, undetectable levels. And so there's evidence now that if you're on treatment for a sufficient amount of time, a few months, under a doctor's care, if you're undetectable means untransmissible. You cannot transmit HIV. And that is a remarkable development compared to many decades where it was either using condoms seemed to be the best and only form of protection. So now that there's a range of protective abilities that can happen. But to get back to your question, yes, even when you are not displaying symptoms, you can infect other people.
And you're supposed to use the medicine for the rest of your life, right?
Absolutely. So it's not a cure. It's a constant requirement of taking the medication to keep the viral development in check. So the virus cannot reproduce or be transmitted when you're on the medication. But if you come off it, you then go back onto that process of progressing towards end-stage HIV disease.
So with that background, can you maybe give us a very brief history as well? I think maybe some of our listeners are familiar with the emergence of it in the 80s and the progression through the 1990s and 2000s, but maybe you can just give us a brief reminder.
Sure. So the traditional story typically starts when medical researchers in the United States were noticing cases of unusual diseases and infections, noticing them among young male patients who were evidently gay. And this was in June 1981. There were 5 cases of young male homosexual patients with pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. And this was followed shortly afterwards in July 1981 with a report of a number of homosexual patients with Kaposi's sarcoma skin cancer. And hence some of the early names for the umbrella syndrome, which was being used to encompass the theorized condition that seemed to link these two types of diseases, the skin cancer and the pneumonia, was that it was some underlying immune disorder. What seemed to link these cases of immune disorder together was, in the researcher's mind, the patient's sexuality. And so a number of phrases that were suggested initially to describe the syndrome of these various cases and diseases related specifically to sexuality. So you had, for example, gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID, or even Wrath of God syndrome, WOGS. And eventually, over time, when there were other groups that began to be linked to this condition, the more neutral phrase, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, was decided upon by late 1982. And so gradually, through 1982, other risk group, was a controversial phrase, were added to homosexuals. You had injection drug users, you had hemophiliacs and blood transfusion recipients, and also Haitians, men and women who had recently arrived in the United States. So by early 1983, based on these epidemiological studies that tried to understand who was at risk and organize the risk factors and risk behaviors, researchers began to work on the model that it was likely a virally transmitted disease like hepatitis B, transmissible via body fluids, shared in sex, by sharing needles, via blood and blood products, and in childbirth. And through 1983 and 1984, you have some fairly intense nationalistic wrangling between American and French researchers claiming to have discovered the causative agent, a virus, and the Nobel Prize eventually went to the French researchers. The causative agent was eventually named HIV because the two groups had their own proprietary phrase for how they wanted it to be identified. But in 1986, it was settled upon as HIV. And through 1983 and 1984, you also have the growing awareness that this disease isn't as was initially thought, concentrated in the United States, but with connections to Haiti that were being explored, and also a large number of cases which seemed to be transmitted heterosexually in a number of African countries, you have the growing awareness that this is an international health crisis. And the story kind of flows from there. Of course, we know subsequently that HIV, because it was slowly spreading and spreading silently and unseen and taking years for people to display symptoms, had been circulating for a long time before it was noticed in 1981. And so you kind of have this parallel subsequent history that is doubling back and looking for examples in frozen blood samples drawn in previous studies around the world to attempt to understand how far back that would go. And the earliest physical sample that exists was drawn in 1959 in what was then the Belgian Congo, what became the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that blood sample, when it was tested and retested with more specific testing methods from the late 80s onwards, indicated that that unknown individual was the first conclusively identified person who had HIV. Before 1959, there are various explanations for how HIV spread, from the antecedent chimpanzee. So scientists were able to work out that the closest ancestral virus to HIV belongs to a simian immunodeficiency virus. So you'll have various claims as to how that infection entered into humans and then arrived at the Democratic Republic of Congo, and then spread from there to arrive and be noticed first in the United States in 1981. It's a big overview, but that kind of gives you a broad strokes picture.
So that was very helpful. Maybe you could say a bit more about how AIDS was thought about in the United States. How did different groups in the United States react to AIDS?
Trying to summarize the multitude of responses would be really tricky. So maybe you can narrow that down a bit.
So to focus things a bit, maybe we could focus on mainstream culture or popular culture and the way AIDS was spoken about or perhaps not spoken about within the public sphere. And specifically, I'm thinking about film. Specifically, I actually taught the class on pandemics and film this past semester. And one of the movies we watched was Philadelphia, which I think was kind of groundbreaking at the time in 1993, if I remember correctly. So if you could maybe say a bit about that context. So the silence in the 80s and how AIDS entered more mainstream discourse, I would say, maybe a bit later.
All right, I'll have a go. We know that the early 1980s saw the arrival of President Reagan in the White House, and he drew a lot of his political support from the religious right. And so there was an ascendant religious view that reanimated much older discussions about how disease is caused. So ideas of plague being God's punishment directly linked to the group that seemed to be the most affected. So I mentioned that homosexuals were one of the risk groups, and the others were all also marginalized groups in various ways. I mean, the fact that I mentioned that an informal phrase used in New York hospitals was wrath of God disease really does suggest the severely damaging consequences and visibility of end-stage HIV disease. So people were being diagnosed with this at the very end of their lives as they were suffering the worst consequences. Their immune systems were shutting down. Sometimes they were having grotesquely deforming forms of cancer with discolorations and lesions, wasting, diarrhea. And so a very difficult position for the members of the gay community who are just beginning to assert themselves more broadly on the national stage and to assert the idea that gay is good. There could be such a thing as a positive and healthy gay sexuality and identity and encouraging people to come out of the closet. To have this disease seem to, like a heat-detecting missile, strike the community, which was so vilified by the religious right and by the government in power, was devastating. And so you have these external forces from outside the gay community, and I use community within quotation marks because it's a really diverse population. You've got all of this criticism coming from without and blame, and you have from within a sense of denial, of reaching to past examples of medical authority trying to demonize and stigmatize homosexuality. I mean, we're less than a decade after the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality as a mental illness from its diagnostic manual. So you have this real resistance amongst activists to any type of assertion that being gay is a deviant form and also is a disease. Anything that would connect being gay with a disease. At the same time as you have the gay community seeming to be most affected by AIDS. And so you have a lot of mobilizing. You have a lot of fighting about whether or not this is something that should be mobilized for. There's a lot of infighting. There's people having to deal with, you know, losing their apartments, being thrown out onto the streets, having to come out to their family members because they'd previously been closeted, and they're doubly coming out of the closet as both gay and having AIDS. So you have periods where there's an intense amount of focus, and then there are periods of time when there is no attention whatsoever. Initially, this is a condition that seemed to affect white gay men predominantly, but then there are also indications that it's not as straightforward as that. You have a number of cases in Black men, in Hispanic men, and a very small number of cases in women. Part of that can be explained by the fact that there was a lot of spread in the gay community, but also there was a resistance to seeing that this could be something that was anything other than homosexually related. And so there was a lack of funding for research to investigate cases of heterosexual transmission, cases among women. There were problems too, as the racial disparities seemed to be becoming more evident. So by the late 1980s, this is being recognized as an epidemic that is shifting much, much more towards racialized minorities. And then you see this process playing out again in different formations. If you have groups that are struggling to achieve any kind of political stability, often relying on a politics of respectability, AIDS is not something that you want to deal with straight on. If you combine high amounts of religiosity, it's essentially a recipe for disaster. So, I mean, there is a lot of scholarship that goes into this. And I'm thinking particularly a recent book, which has just come out, which I'm enjoying reading right now, by Dan Royals, which examines the African-American struggle against HIV/AIDS. It really goes into these dynamics a lot more. I haven't even touched upon film. What I'd like to say is by 1993, when Philadelphia comes out, it's towards the end phase of the early part of the AIDS epidemic, the scary, deadly early years. By 1996, you have a total sea change in the way that the epidemic is experienced, because that's the date of the wide availability of effective antiretroviral therapy. So you can really think of, at least in the United States, in Canada, in countries that had access to these drugs, you can think of the period from 1981 to 1995, 96 is the beginning, and things changing substantially. That's not to deny all the problems relating to racialized health outcomes that were becoming evident over time and still do characterize HIV to this day. But 1993 was towards the end of this first phase. And, you know, survival rates are starting to edge up a little bit as people are being caught earlier. And there are some treatments like AZT that are offered, but it's still, Philadelphia would represent kind of a very widely recognized traditional Hollywood film dealing with a topic that was then being permitted to be talked about, yeah, quite late in that early phase.
So yeah, I think that was a helpful way to think about AIDS in popular culture. One way in which I think it did earlier manifest is this idea that you've worked on, which is of patient zero. So can you maybe shortly define what that is, and then we'll use that as a jumping off point perhaps to talk about our obsession with origins of diseases?
So I think it's important to say that there is no one single idea of what patient zero is, chiefly because the term came about by a series of accidents over time. And people have found the phrase useful because of its interpretive flexibility. Like, it can mean what they want it to, but it leads to quite a bit of confusion. Essentially, patient zero is the notion that an infectious disease outbreak can be traced to a single individual. Some would say that it should only properly refer to the first ever human case. So a case of spilling over from an animal host, like, for example, the simian immunodeficiency virus that gave rise to HIV, that first human case would be the only person we could call patient zero. And I have a lot of problems with this, as I talk about in my writing, but yeah, that would be a popular understanding of what patient zero might be.
Just to ask, why patient zero and not patient one?
That's a really obvious question. And so one part of the answer is because of the accidental formation of the phrase. Nobody set out to say, well, I mean that this should mean this instance. There were a number of parts to it. You have the phrase patient O being used as part of an early epidemiological study carried out by investigators, Centers for Disease Control, investigating the possibility of the sexual transmission of a causative agent. This is before a virus was identified. You have in the reporting of this study in an internal and external publications, the use of an O and a zero in close proximity and being used interchangeably and not being able to tell them apart. And especially you also have an image that centers the individual labeled as patient O or patient zero in the middle of a network that is suggestive of transmission originating from the central point. And then you have a further evolution of the phrase when it's adopted and popularized in a best-selling popular history of the early AIDS epidemic in the United States, Randy Schultz's book, And the Band Played On. And, you know, a lot of people have read And the Band Played On. Far more people read or read publicity relating to it. The news stories that it launched as part of the publicity campaign, and millions more watched a 60 Minutes news report, which was one of the first pieces that CBS 60 Minutes had done on the AIDS epidemic. And it was focused on the idea of patient zero. So because of that accidental formation over time, that's one of the reasons why you don't have it being patient one. And I think as well, the reason Randy Schultz decided to popularize it was when he was hearing researchers talk about it, he later reported saying, "Oh, that's catchy." And he really had a good ear and an eye for a story, what he thought the readers, his readers would want to read. And so Patient Zero in his rendition became a focal point and a central character in explaining how AIDS had spread in the United States, how HIV had spread. And it's based in part on Randy Schultz's incorrect understanding of this early epidemiological research.
That's very interesting. Now, as far as I know, Patient Zero is often used to describe AIDS. When do other diseases get their own Patient Zero?
So that process really starts to happen in the 1990s. And other guests with your episodes with Priscilla Wald and with Nancy Toms talking about the end, the 1990s being this process where there is increasing discussions about the risk of transmission. And so you start seeing it in news reports relating to Ebola. And I think a crucial thing to say is that before the AIDS epidemic, the phrase patient zero didn't exist. The idea of the importance of the earliest known case long existed. And we can talk about that in terms of explaining the causation of disease, the causation of epidemics, which has long been a challenge for explanatory systems, for cosmologies, for different ways of understanding causation. But the phrase patient zero did not exist until this accidental formation. But because of the huge attention given to the phrase in relation to how AIDS was thought to have originated and spread in the early 1980s, with reference to this individual, Randy Schultz and the publicity, the media campaign, the reporting around and the ban played on, established a framework for subsequent epidemics to be reported in, a kind of a genre. And then you see that happening again and again. And it established a sense amongst reporters and also amongst editors that this was something that the readers would want to see and read about. And so you get to SARS again, you have stories about a patient zero, and H1N1, swine flu, you have a hunt for patient zero. So major disease outbreaks with a global attention following this fall into that pattern. And also in movies too. And at a later stage, it becomes a more general, a metaphoric description for often for the first case of something.
So this brings up, at least in my mind, a very interesting point is a lot of your work is both showing how this developed and pointing out problems with this narrative. And something obviously Lee and I have been thinking about in our own work is something very similar, right? Which is how do you push back on a very popular idea that's very simple, right? It's very seductive, like patient zero, or like our own work when it comes to the Justinianic plague.
And of course, can you do that? Can you actually push back against these ideas?
A good question. So as you know, I've done some writing in response to COVID-19, drawing upon this history to explain why the phrase patient zero is really unhelpful. Like, why would you use a phrase that doesn't mean what anybody says that they think it means? If you're referring to the first instance, that person might not be a patient. They might never seek treatment. So there are better ways of referring to the thing that you want to use. So I've wavered between thinking it's important to point that out and seeing that there is broader understanding that comes, you know, there's, you know, this stuff is being read, but it's also feel like the little boy with his finger in the dam trying to prevent something, whereas you then see it being replicated on a mass level. Yeah, I think there might be smarter ways of using energy. And I'm thinking of when Nancy Toms was on the show, and she was kind of saying that she kind of despaired a bit about all the work that she was doing and whether it was being picked up. And I also think that maybe one thing that we can do as historians is to get away from the idea that by saying it once, it's enough. I was listening to a radio interview with a very well-respected and quite like late in her life computer scientist talking about the number of times that she had had to repeat and repeat and repeat that women could perform at the same level in this discipline as men. And it kind of made me think, okay, well, maybe actually I should be prepared to repeat this over and over and over again, and not just assume that by publishing a book on the topic, it should be done. In some ways, I feel like my explanations are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And so I think I just need to have like a single phrase, which I just, you know, put on repeat again and again.
Yeah. I mean, as Lee knows, we've long been joking about marketing and branding as kind of a sideshow of this podcast as a whole. And in some ways, though, it does really drive that home, what you're saying, which is you've shown the problem with this narrative, but at the same time, it still maintains its powerful hold because I think it has become, as you just pointed out, so conceptually malleable, right? It can almost mean whatever you want it to mean as this black box, and it's really useful in that regard for people.
It also seems very intuitive. It's obvious until it's not really obvious.
Something interesting that I've been reflecting on is that probably the most attention I've received for my work is when I teamed up with a group of scientists, some molecular biologists, who were attempting to study and do a genomic analysis of early HIV samples that were taken from a study done in the late 70s of gay men, and their blood samples were drawn and retrospectively found that HIV were in a number of samples, and these scientists went in to try and do extensive genomic analysis of the HIV and then compare these to patient zero sample, which he had donated to the CDC while he was alive and had subsequently been tested. This got a huge amount of attention. It was like front page New York Times. It was when you're used to, you know, getting a few views here and there of a historical piece, and then to kind of have all of your notification feeds kind of like melting down because of simultaneous embargo release, 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, it all goes live. It was interesting that everybody now seems to know about patient zero and that the flight attendant did not cause the North American AIDS epidemic. That simple message got through. The notion that patient zero is not a useful phrase did not. So that feels like the part two. And maybe one lesson there is that we need to seek broad-based alliances to other researchers who have better access to reporting and media attention. And we live in a culture that glorifies science. So, yeah.
Right. One of the things that we've noticed both on the podcast and in our own work is that scientists just have a louder voice, and not necessarily because of them being scientists, but because of the broader ecosystem of really media research and the aura that science has within our societies.
So keeping in mind ideas of the power of stories, as we've just been discussing, how do you think historians should work publicly, whether it be with scientists, in terms of our thinking of diseases, maybe using HIV as your platform here, or thinking more broadly in terms of COVID? What are some possibilities that might advance where historians are at the table, behind the table, or not even at the table at all?
That's a good question. I've found myself fielding a number of calls from journalists wanting to know why understanding patient zero was important for the arrival of COVID in their countries. And I spent a lot of time with each of them saying, you know, I'll explain this, but I'm going to tell you why it's not important, why it's the wrong question to ask. And my experience here was that that's important work, but frankly, having done a number of those calls, I decided to write the piece that I published in The Conversation to try and get out and more efficiently what I thought was important. And I think there is a need to pull back or to limit the amount of time spent with journalists if it comes at the cost of doing other work. I think there's a need for historians to think about whether we wish to have a place at the policymaking table to give context, and whether we see our role as giving context to people in power making decisions. There have been a number of times where I've thought, and other historians I've spoken to have thought, that it would be really good if people in power had better command of histories to inform the decisions that they're making. But this, I think, will come into challenges with relation to, you know, there's disagreements amongst historians. We're very split about whether our work should have a focus on policy or whether we should be removed from that space. It's challenging to condense the work, which is very often very long, into condensed, readable, actionable pieces. One thing I do think is probably easier to recommend is to increasingly work in teams. I feel like the piece you mentioned on COVID that came out in Centaurus, like that was a co-production with Erica Charters at Oxford, who's a colleague. And we've not had a chance to write anything together before. And that was a really great way of spurring each other on and coming up with something together. And I think the idea of sharing with other disciplines, I've been doing some work with an anthropologist at Cambridge, Alexa Hegarty, who has been really helpful in helping me to think about issues of trust as they relate to contact tracing in COVID. So I think teaming up is something that historians have been reluctant to do in the past. Our discipline has valorized the lone investigator heroically soldiering off the archives and having eureka moments and coming back to produce this, you know, individually created masterpiece. And it's exhausting and it's lonely. And there are times when I want to work on something myself, but I want to do more collaboration. And I think there are real benefits that could come with that. And that could help us with our public facing work.
So how would you tell these stories in the context of COVID? And maybe when would you tell these stories in the context of COVID? Should we start telling these stories now?
I think one thing that we can do in relation to how we try to tell our stories with COVID is to try as best as we can to be self-aware narrators of these stories, and that we commit to constantly learn. So bring as much of our historical expertise into understanding the present and using the present to address and update what we might have thought about the past. And I definitely feel that I'm in this interplay between thinking about the work I've done on the AIDS epidemic and thinking about living through COVID and, for example, experiencing for myself the hyper-intense calls to responsible behavior and policing of behavior that seems to deviate from that. I wrote about that in my work on Patient Zero, and it's something different to feel it. I don't think I revise my conclusions, but it enriches that process. Another thing I think is to do it with a healthy dose of humility, to be aware. And Erica and I say, kind of finish our piece on COVID in the history of science and medicine with this note, really kind of saying we cannot know how the future will interpret what we're writing now, but we could probably be fairly certain that it will heavily revise what we might think when brought in with a lot of other experiences, a broader perspective, and greater distance from the present. So trying to be self-aware and telling our stories with humility would be how I'd answer that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and why I really like the special issue you put together is I think it will be useful for people in the future to see where historians were at particular moments during COVID and how they were using it, shaping their own narratives moving forward. Something I've written about that'll be out later this year, thinking about where you are after 3 months or 6 months or 9 months and reflecting back on how this has changed or not. So I think that's a really good point and why, as I said, I think that'll be a wonderful issue to look back on and what held up and what didn't. As historians, we're always willing to revise what worked and what didn't. So with that, I wanted to thank you so much, Rich, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rich.
So that was a really broad, sweeping episode. I think that's talked about a disease, talked about social reactions to it, talked about stories we tell about disease, and how we're thinking about diseases during COVID today.
Yeah, and I think that we really barely scratched the surface of what we can talk about with regards to AIDS, and maybe more broadly, the social and cultural implications of AIDS, which are huge. And at least some of them did come out in the episode, but we should definitely have Rich back at some point in the future, as we've spoken that we'll probably do with some of our guests from this year.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I also think there's a number of other guests on this topic that we can bring on. And as I said at the beginning, I think we haven't done this mostly just because it's such a big topic and it's so daunting to wade into a field like that.
Yeah, it definitely is daunting. Now, one of the things that I've been thinking about is that there is this impression, right, that we're kind of over AIDS. I mean, we solved the AIDS problem. So yeah, there's still AIDS. There's still people with AIDS, but they're out of sight, really. And AIDS doesn't really seem to be a threat anymore. But I actually went and checked the numbers, and it seems that so far from the early 1980s, 33 million people died of AIDS worldwide. So again, just to put the COVID pandemic in context, and every year, in 2019 at least, almost 700,000 people worldwide died of AIDS. So the numbers are pretty high and much higher than what I would expect or guess before checking those numbers out.
Yeah, I think that would be a useful future episode, is reflecting upon not just the origins and the early decades, but where the field stands now. I think there's probably a number of practitioners, global health experts, who we could bring on to do something like that.
What I'm trying to say is that AIDS lost its attractiveness. So maybe, as you say, thinking about AIDS or the late phase of AIDS or the more recent phase of AIDS would probably be very different from thinking about the early phase of AIDS, which I think has drawn much more attention. And at least old people like us, even older people, probably remember much better.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a question of global north versus global south, right? I mean, that's the bare minimum.
Yeah.
One of the interesting points I thought that he made, and as you know, Leah, I was keen to chat with Rich about, was the idea and the stories that are told. And so I think you were really excited, interested, blown away, fascinated to learn the origin of patient zero, right? And why it's not patient one, seemed to be one of your favorite moments of the podcast.
Yeah, I think that actually ties pretty well to the episode we had on our own article. This was some 4 or 5 episodes ago, I think. Because I think it's the same phenomenon. In both these cases, an idea is attractive enough, to use a cliche, take a life of its own and just spread. I mean, you could actually use the disease metaphor itself, right? It spreads around the world, infects people, so on, as a meme or something in the original version, the Dawkins version. But I think this touches upon something we should be more aware of. And I say we, as in citizens of the world in the 21st century, that these ideas, even the very simple, very attractive ideas that are very easily thrown around by experts and non-experts, once we actually focus our attention on these ideas and try to understand where they came from and how they were created, when they were created, by who they were created, the answers to these questions become much more complex and, I would say, interesting as well.
Yeah, although I think, as he pointed out, you still have to have a short, concise pushback and narrative that you tell in response. And that was what he discussed as well, which I thought was useful to think with, both for us and for everyone dealing with many of these similar questions.
Which I think actually ties into one of the discussions we've had and what should we do in the future. And I know that in some of our own discussions, you have told me multiple times that you're kind of sick of saying the same thing over and over again, and whether in academic talks or in writing, and you would want to move on. And in a sense, I understand that, right? I mean, you're curious, you want to do more things, you're looking for new challenges and so on. But if you take what Rich is saying, you could understand it as meaning that actually you should keep the same message and push the same message over and over again, even if it's very Sisyphic, because that's the only way in which things might change. And in his case, about patient zero, maybe, in our case, about, let's say, the plague concept or the effects of the Justinianic plague or so on.
Yeah, but I also think you have to build upon that and to think about why you're doing stuff. And that's why, as I said, I really liked the special issue that came out in Centaurus that he was part of, because that was a first stage thinking of COVID. And I've done something similar, and I think it's useful to reflect upon that. Right? I mean, he also mentioned, very similar to Nancy Toms, about how a lot of what he's thought in his own work has shifted as he lives through COVID. Nancy pointed out she realized that there was ways in which she was handling library books that were very similar to how people were doing this in the early 20th century. And Rich had a similar take on the situation.
Yeah, Nancy is probably another of those guests that we might want to bring back for, I don't know, a reunion or like a second season or whatever. But I think we could probably say the same about ourselves as well, or at least I can say the same about myself, that living through COVID has made me think more about realities in the past, realities in the past pandemics that I research, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, another interesting point that obviously I enjoyed talking to him about was the policy conversation, which, as you know, Lee, I'm keen to think about. I don't have an answer yet, but it obviously linked up quite nicely with Lucas Engelmann's episode, where we talked about how COVID epidemiological modeling was done and some of the problems, it seems like, in the UK. And I think Rich is thinking about some of these things as well.
Right. And I think that the fact that quite a few people, I wouldn't say many, but quite a few people, historians around us, have been speaking about these ideas seems at least partially to be connected, related to COVID. And it might, I hope at least, signal that some change is in the air. Some change might happen over the maybe not very near future, but maybe it would take a bit longer.
I think hopefully enough people thinking about how to do this and the mechanisms by which they may do this would eventually push people into thinking differently, acting differently, and maybe ultimately changing how historians approach some of these ideas.
Right. And if we want to continue using the table metaphor, I think what we're seeing here is that historians are becoming more and more aware that they want to have a seat at the table. And the question is whether they could find that seat at the table and whether the other guests at the table or people at the table or institutions or whatever at the table would be willing to give them a seat, or would historians take it without being given? I don't know. But I think the discourse surrounding this question today is very different from the discourse, actually the absence of discourse surrounding similar questions that I was aware of at least, let's say 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, maybe to think through my children for a minute, who love to climb up into my lap as I'm eating dinner at the table. Maybe that's the way we have to do it, just disrupt the whole table itself.
Yeah, and started screaming. Yeah, that actually might work.
Yeah. So speaking of kids, Lee, you mentioned your daughter's first birthday is coming up. Are you planning, you know, a theme for your party? I know you
I think the answer is pretty obviously no.
Well, I know you're not exactly a pro-consumer guy. We'll put it that way.
Okay, yes. There's no theme. I did go for shopping this week on a couple of occasions, actually, to find open stores that might have things that would work as part of this birthday. And surprise, surprise, there haven't been many. Probably a miserable Target equivalent was open, but the entire party aisles were closed. And they were closed because they're not allowed to sell those things because of competition, right? So because all the other stores are closed because of lockdown, so this Target equivalent can sell anything related to parties or toys or anything like that, right? So you go there and those aisles are blocked, physically blocked.
You know, I'll just say this, Lee. These are the type of stories I think you should tell in the opening segment, not, you know, your grand political, there's lockdown, we're all angry. But I think listeners would, at least I just learned, something very interesting, kind of random about Israel, right? Which is, on one level, probably some policy person thought this was a good idea, right? That if store A through Y can't sell things, then why should store Z? But it also speaks to where are you supposed to get these things then?
No, so there was actually a strong push against this. I think this was in the previous lockdown. It's hard to keep track, but I think it was the previous lockdown. And until then, I remember going to my supermarket, which is usually just about food, and you would see them having lots of toys. They were just selling toys because nobody else was selling any toys. So they obviously had an edge and capitalized upon that until that was locked down by other people and small business owners and so, who just said, I mean, we're both out of business because you're locking down our stores. And also, what are we supposed to do? Because our business, even our internet business, which is not big in Israel at all, is being taken over by these chains, supermarket chains, really.
I'll just say one thing. If you haven't learned the magic of buying used toys off of Facebook Parents Marketplace, then you should get into that.
No, of course I do that. That's forgiven. But the point is that, for example, I wanted balloons, right? And you cannot get balloons in the store that's supposed to sell balloons. You just can't get them. And then I went to the supermarket, which did sell balloons. But then, you know, they have those balloons, like big digit balloons, like a big one or a big zero or whatever.
Yeah. I'm quite familiar with this.
So the funny thing in the supermarket that did sell these things is that they had no awareness that the ones would get bought much faster than the twos and threes and fours, right? Because you need ones for all the teen birthdays. You don't need that many twos or threes and fours and so on. So for everything, all the candles, all the balloons, all the digit candles, digit balloons, and so on, there were no ones at all. And you had like dozens and whatever of nines and eights and any other number. I could find only 10 for what it's worth.
So I'll just say two things. Number one, capitalism has done so poorly in your country, clearly. And number two, you got to get original. You buy a three and a two, and then you buy an extra two, you break off the bottom of the two, and you make it three minus two.
Okay, so that brings us to another point. Now, what are these first birthdays for? Right? Maybe you can tell me, as someone with definitely more experience than I have, what are they for?
So first of all, I just want to say that you were clearly blown away by the ingenuity of the three minus two idea, and I can see now you're going to do this.
No, wait, listen to what I have to say, but go on.
The point is to gather your family together to celebrate the grandchild.
Who's actually celebrating? Who's at the center of this?
If you want to be very cynical, you are.
Of course. I don't think that's being cynical at all. One of the other parents in the daycare actually said that to us explicitly. I mean, this is about you guys, about us parents, that is. And everyone's coming to celebrate that our kids survived the year. I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So if it's about us, and I think the way I understand this is that you're supposed to put on some kind of show, right? You're supposed to show that you're like conforming to some standard of what a good parent is supposed to do. And buying threes and twos, Merle, and chopping things off is just not going to be good enough.
I'm so excited for when your daughter becomes like this massive consumer capitalist and, you know, you have to buy her all this stuff someday. That's all I got to say.
Well, okay. So you might be interested in another story. I actually took her to buy the gifts for her birthday, right? Because she didn't really understand what we were doing or anything. But this was the first time, as far as I understand, of her being aware, or at least slightly aware of what's going on within one of these stores. And she was like shocked. She was like mind blown by all the stuff that was around there. And she started like throwing fits everywhere, which is not something she does usually. I mean, usually we're just at home. We take her to the park, take her to daycare. She could do whatever she wants in those places. But here he had like tons of toys and she couldn't eat them or touch them or like play with them and open their bags and stuff. So yeah, that was an interesting experience for me as well, having a almost one-year-old screaming in my hands inside a shop. And I just wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible.
I'll say this before we go, Lee. You've obviously, because of COVID, interestingly, be able to miss a lot of the less than fun experiences with your daughter when it involves stores and shopping. So these are obviously going to all come back tenfold once you can do this.
I cannot wait. And I guess that on this note of expecting a better future, whatever that means, we can probably conclude this episode. We'd like to thank the Page Center for funding us, and as usual, our webmaster, Verid Rakhanati.
Until next time, stay safe, stay socially distanced, and maybe, if you can, mail Lee some candles that have the number 1 on it.